BCG believes that creating climate solutions is the defining challenge of our generation. So we're working with leaders everywhere to understand and mitigate the cost of climate inaction. But we're also helping them find ways to innovate, build sustainable businesses, and stay competitive in an evolving world. Stick around to discover the many opportunities in a more sustainable global economy.
Welcome to Zero. I am Akshat Rathi. It's an interesting moment in the climate fight. 2024 will be a year of many big elections around the world. And the governments that end up with power will determine the pace of the energy transition. No matter what politics prevail, one thing that will continue to speed up the transition is technology. But even there, the picture is a little bit mixed right now. Last year saw record spending on clean energy reaching $1.7 trillion. That's $600 billion more than what was spent on fossil fuels. And yet, it is still far short of the $4.5 trillion in clean energy investment needed to be on track to meet climate goals. And by design, clean energy spending is front-loaded with the cost of installing, say, solar panels or wind turbines or hydrogen electrolyzers. That's becoming more difficult in an environment with high interest rates. And of course, those are not the only technologies the world needs. Industrial sectors like steel, cement, and plastics also need to be decarbonized. Earlier stage technologies need venture capital funding, which is also falling. But some emerging companies have found a way to successfully take their technology to the market. How did they do it? That's the question I asked Claire Curry, Global Head of Technology, Industry and Innovation at Bloomberg NEF. We also talked about investment trends in climate tech and how to find the best early stage startups. Claire, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, one of the things that is poorly understood about the energy transition is how much climate tech and climate tech investments from early stage all the way to scaling them up matters. And we're going to talk a lot about how exactly that works, how different types of startups have used that journey to try and make the commercial case for being around. But let's start with a basic understanding of where we stand on investments in the energy transition. Now, Bloomberg NEF put out a report saying last year was a record investment year. $1.7 trillion were invested in all kinds of clean energy technologies at scale. But that is still far from what is needed. We're about a third of the way for the energy transition to be on track for net zero. If you look at that number, the 1.7 trillion number, how do you think about where the energy transition is going and which of the sectors are getting that kind of money?
We're at a really pivotal moment right now in the transition. We've spent 15 years or so scaling solar, wind, lithium ion, so batteries, really those three things actually. And that's been amazing, huge effort. And most of that 1.7 trillion went to those three areas, plus some investment in grid expansion. That's great. We need lots more of that. So keep on building those projects. And they've really worked towards at least a path for us to see how we can clean up the power sector and at least passenger vehicle transport sector through electrification. So that's almost half of the CO2 pie. We emitted about 37 gigatons of CO2 last year. Almost half of that. We have a route to decarbonize. We're far from doing it, but we know how we can do it. It's now a scaling investment problem. It's not a technology problem. I mean, I'm generalizing. We still have commercial transport, industry materials, and ag and food to decarbonize. And we are less certain how to do that. There are some cool technologies, and we'll talk about them, but many aren't scaled, and many are scalable but aren't getting the financing. Well, really, where we are now actually is, I said it's pivotal because last year, for the first time, we began to see the tens of billions being invested into those technologies to scale the other half of the pie. Those technologies include carbon capture, hydrogen, drop-in biofuels, some nuclear, some geothermal, heat pumps for electrification of buildings. And we saw, I mean, for CCS, it was about $11 billion was invested in projects that are going to get built. Hydrogen was about $10 billion. So we're seeing small numbers, but obviously it's a fraction of that 1.7 you mentioned, trillion.
Now, that is the total amount of investment going in. And this is, of course, the tens of billions are typically towards commercial scale. But most of the technology that will be crucial for reducing emissions from industry and from agriculture are still at an early stage. And one of the ways in which these early stage technologies get to scale is through a model that's been perfected over the past 3-4 decades, the venture capital model, where you have investors who are taking on a big risky bet, typically 100 companies and maybe 10 of them will become commercial, 90 will fail. And that's been a very important part of the climate tech story. In recent years, VC investments have just been going up and up. That's starting to change now. The numbers that you have for Bloomberg NEF show that things are flattening.
That's true. And that's actually not, it's not a reflection of the appetite in the market. There's actually more dry powder, i.e. money that's been raised by climate funds that hasn't been spent yet, than ever before. I think it's about $50 billion. There's lots of appetite to raise money in this space. The challenge is just generally macroeconomics. As we all know, the economy has not been great for venture capital because of interest rates. Last year, the global VC market fell in terms of dollars spent by 38%. The year before, it was as much again. So really, it's a 2021 huge peak. We've now seen a huge drop. Climate tech, therefore, you could say, being steady the last 2 years is a success story because it now comprises a higher percentage of the total market than it used to. But there is quite a lot of nuance in there, and it means we may continue to see it flat, which obviously is not good for startups trying to raise money.
And the reason why, even though venture capital itself is falling, investments in early stage companies has remained flat in how you measure it at Bloomberg NEF, which is venture capital and private equity money. So why is the PE part, the private equity part, so important in this story?
Yeah, so the way we track the VC or startup climate tech financing world is to track deals, money raised by startups. Now, we classify a startup in our space as anyone that's privately backed, so not public, raising from angel and seed stage, the very small amounts of money, really right through to the whole alphabet, right? It's Series A through to probably G. At what point they normally get acquired or they go public or they scale to a point where they don't need to raise private money anymore. They're profitable. That means many of those companies at Series A, great, they're just raising VC money. Many of the companies at Series C through to G are actually attracting now what we would call growth equity. It's not classic PE that do a lot of M&A. It's more companies that have that want to write $100 million check sizes because their fund is $2 billion size. They're definitely not the VC size. We think that money is going to be increasingly important. So we track it because actually it is an increasing share of the pie, particularly in Asia.
And this is a very good place to understand the journey of a startup, right? Roughly there are 5 stages. You can slice and dice it different ways. The first is you invent a technology. Then second is pilot. The third is you demo it. You show that it can actually work at a reasonable scale. Then you build what would be a first-of-a-kind commercial plant. And then you finally build a scaled-up plant. In my head, the easiest way to understand it is to think about a steel startup, for example. An invention is making grams in a lab. Pilot is making kilograms in a startup, in a decent lab, but not a big lab. A demo is where you make tons of that material. In your first-of-a-kind, you're making thousands of tons. And then in the commercial scale, you're making millions of tons. So that each step is sort of 1,000 times more than what you've done in the past. And many of these startups have struggled at a very particular stage, which is going from demo to commercial. There's the first of a kind plant that needs to be built. Let us talk through a few examples of some of the companies that have achieved that.
Yeah, it's often called the Valley of Death, which sounds very dramatic, but many startups fail at that point. It's probably helpful for me to mention a few reasons before we go into the examples. One is the kind of capital you need changes. VCs might fund, as you say, your kilograms of production. They aren't big enough check sizes to fund the hundreds of millions of dollars you need to raise for your commercial. So you need to suddenly attract project equity from banks or PE firms or other investment firms, and maybe debt. Both of those are incredibly hard to attract because they don't like technology risk. They don't like first of a kind. If they do, they charge you lots of money and then your project becomes unprofitable. They like profit margins, and that's quite hard to achieve for a lot of climate tech, particularly first of a kind. They like secure guaranteed revenues. And that, again, is tricky if your first of a kind is making a brand new product never made before, or if you're making a product with a green price premium, among many other things. But those are some of the challenging reasons to get from demo to commercial.
And there are examples that we need to pick, and particularly maybe examples that are in these harder sectors, such as industry or agriculture. One that comes to mind that I've followed for some time now is LanzaTech. This company is now more than 10 years old, came up at a time when there was a demand for the product it was making, and then it went through a very difficult cycle of that product not having that investment. Just talk us through its journey.
Yeah, LanzaTech is a great example. Founded in 2005. So actually, yeah, pretty old. And I think it's the first thing. This stuff takes time. It's very rare to see a startup founded and then bang, 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 they get through all those five steps in a few years. So yeah, it's taken them some time. They actually went public, I think, last year, but privately backed by VCs up to then. In a nutshell, they have a microbe, well, many microbe types that turn nasty kind of industrial gases or waste biomass to ethanol. When they were founded, their US market was very keen on ethanol as the future of road transportation. So that was their target market. As you said, since ethanol still exists, it's a huge market, but it's no longer the darling of the transport market future, it's pivoted. And they've done two things really well. One is most startups have to build, own, operate. That's the demo to commercial valley of death, raising hundreds of millions of dollars. LanzaTech instead found a niche of clients willing to actually license its technology from day one, pre-commercial project, and then pay to build the plants. That's pretty cool. They did this through seeking out Chinese steel companies that were mandated to stop emitting lots of unburnt, nasty processes from coal to steel from their plants. And so the government mandated them, you need to do this or we'll shut you down. So they formed a JV, paid LanzaTech to license the technology to eat up their nasty off-gases, turn it to ethanol. LanzaTech had the option to buy the ethanol and sell it on. So that's two revenue streams straight from the bat. It's the licensing of the tech and it's the ethanol revenue and de-risking them needing to invest in the projects.
And the build-to-operate model versus a licensing model is basically a capital play. If you're building and operating, you are going to be spending hundreds of millions of dollars doing that. When you're licensing, you're actually generating revenue immediately. You're not actually putting in the money yourself. And so that allows a startup to be able to continue scaling its technology and also learning from somebody else building it out.
Completely. You're de-risking a lot. The reason people don't do it, twofold. One, obviously it's less money overall. Licensing revenues are going to be much less than if you own the plant and sell the output of the plant. Second, really hard to persuade a customer to license your tech if it's unproven. But LanzaTech managed that. The second thing that they're doing that's really cool is they've been flexible with the output product. Not possible for everyone, but for chemicals companies, definitely possible. And they've proven a way of also getting companies to pay them to do the R&D, which is pretty cool. So they now have revenue from projects they've done with Lululemon and H&M to make low carbon fibers for clothing. They've been paid by L'Oreal to produce new low carbon plastic packaging. So it's really cool to see they're able to get that third revenue stream from new R&D. And then they're developing, as I said, I think I said about 20 different high value chemicals from the ethanol, higher profit margins, and much more diversified, which means lower risk.
More from the conversation after the break.
Today's leaders face many hard choices, confronted with uncertainty, cost pressures, and growing shareholder demands. But they don't have to choose between pursuing climate and business goals. In fact, BCG research suggests that these ambitions go hand in hand. Did you know at least 40% of executives at large organizations estimate an annual financial benefit of $100 million for meeting emissions reduction targets, according to recent BCG research? BCG also found that transitioning to the circular economy could help unlock $4.5 trillion of GDP growth by 2030. The cost of inaction, however, is profound. In fact, further analysis indicates that missing climate targets could result in an average annual EBITDA reduction of 15%. At BCG, our experts recognize the myriad benefits, from risk mitigation to first-mover advantage, that come with sustainability. Let's partner to unlock a better sustainability journey.
Let's look at another recent darling of the investment industry, especially in climate tech. H2 Green Steel last year raised billions of dollars, which is very difficult to raise, A, because of the environment it is in, but also just the sheer number, right? Climate tech companies raising billions of dollars are countable on fingers. And so what was it about H2 Green Steel, a company that's going to try and make steel without the carbon emissions, gaining that much money?
Yeah, and they were only founded in 2020. So they bucked the trend I mentioned earlier. Part of that is we are now seeing companies scale faster to commercial because suddenly the last 3 years, everyone's woken up to the fact climate change is here and we need to decarbonize these hard to abate sectors. So it's right time, right place. Great backers. They have a very experienced team from industry. That all helps, I think, reassure investors. And you're right, they raised almost, I think, about 7 billion euros to build their first commercial project. They've done two things, which is clever, and I think could be replicable in steel, but in other industries too. The first is they managed to convince investors that they are not technologically risky, which is fascinating because they're really a first of a kind in many of the technologies they're using. But they license, they're not actually technology inventors. They are licensing tech from many other players, hence why they can scale so quick. And their secret sauce is enough expert executors who they've hired out of the industry who say, we can build a project, greenfield, so from scratch, that is perfectly optimized and digitalized and cutting edge equipment, which means we can make the cheapest kind of green steel out there compared to other companies doing retrofits or other stuff. That's the first thing. And that actually attracted debt and project equity that otherwise probably wouldn't have been interested in a first of a kind. The second thing they did was sign off takes. You can de-risk your project as much as you want, but without customer demand, it's hard to get investors. And potentially because of their network, they managed to sign off takes with Mercedes-Benz, Scania, IKEA, loads of really big brand names who are willing to pay up to 50% premium for the steel because it's low carbon.
And these customers, the steel component is actually a very small part of the products they typically sell. Like a Mercedes-Benz, steel is going to be, what, 1, 2% of the price of the car? But if that 1 or 2% becomes 3%, doesn't really matter. But then it does matter on their carbon footprint. It does matter in their marketing of the goods. And those connections were readily available to H2 Green Steel because they had backers in the battery space. They had backers from this other startup, Northvolt, which is making batteries that has connections into the auto industry.
Yeah, exactly. That definitely helped. I think the jury's still out on how big the green premium green steel market can get. Yes, you can sell. I mean, I think the Mercedes-Benz offtake was about 50,000 tons, so it's not huge. So really, it's a drop in the ocean of all the other steel that they're buying. You're right, if you made an entire chassis of a car with green steel, it would cost about 2% more to the consumer. If that's a very high-end, electric, low-carbon vehicle sold to a wealthy individual, you're right, it doesn't matter. It might matter to the average person. And the real question about green materials, not as green steel, but green plastics, green cement, if there is this persistent premium required, does it hit a ceiling? The example always used is fair trade coffee, right? People love the idea of fair trade, but it hit a ceiling and it really hasn't grown as a market in a decade because those who can afford to pay more do, but that percentage of people isn't growing. And so will we see the same thing with green steel? Will it remain to the premium of German automakers who can afford it? Or will it actually end up being embedded in all of our buildings, our bridges and so forth? For a different topic, a different time, there's some really cool work governments are doing to try and procure green materials and make that reality true for everyone, not just rich car buyers, but it may not work.
Well, the theory is that at least initially, if you can get to a place where somebody's buying the green premium, you make enough of it, you make enough plants that make it, that green premium actually goes away. Now, that's just theory, right?
Yes.
Because at fair trade, that's the case that hasn't been proven out to be true. But before we get into what are some other bets that could try and maybe crush this green premium to zero or even negative, let's talk through the third example.
So the third example is interesting. It's an area that I think people know less about than the other two. And it's the area of plastics recycling, which is both a waste problem, it's also a net zero problem. Today, plastics, about 10% of our plastics is recycled globally, so it's pitiful. And almost all, basically all of that is mechanical recycling. It will only take clear, like plastic bottle type things, and it will make worse quality plastics from it, like throwaway cutlery. So it's not great. There is a whole wave of new, mostly startups, developing this thing called chemical recycling. Basically, you can take in a stream of dirty, coloured, mixed waste plastic and turn it into a pseudo kind of crude oil again, really. And that can then be used and upgraded into anything. And it's completely circular forever and ever. And our company we're going to talk about is Mura Technologies. They commissioned last year their first ever commercial plant in the UK doing exactly this process, chemical recycling. And it's pretty exciting. It's 20,000 tons per annum they're making. And they've been around since 2011. So again, it's taken them quite a long time to get here.
Now, as a chemist, recycling of plastics is possible. It's always been a cost problem, right? So what is it that Mura has been able to do that they've been able to overcome that and actually make a commercial case for their product?
Yes, recycling doesn't make money generally. At this moment in time, may not be true forever, but we're seeing low scrap plastics prices, particularly for waste plastic that literally otherwise it's going to get landfilled. And so you are paying very little for your feedstock, which is tick one of kind of business model excellence for climate tech startups. Second, there is a lot of policy right now in the UK and France and the EU generally that is mandating. In the UK, the mandate is 30% of plastic made has to be recycled or circular economy plastic. Now that just isn't available right now to producers. They're really scrambling, and that has enabled a price premium. No, it's not a subsidy. It's really just the government mandating has meant companies are desperate to buy this product that Mura has, which means companies like Mura, our BNEF calculations show about a 13% IRR. Now normal chemicals plants are about 8%. So this is a better investment just without the green tag than investing in other chemicals projects.
Right. And IRR is just the rate of return. So 13% for every $1 million that's invested.
Exactly.
And these are companies now that are at that place where they have gone over the valley of death, built a first of a kind, and are starting to get to the commercial stage. But among the many things that BNEF does, you also go at the very early stage of startups and you try and identify, given there are now hundreds of these coming up every year, the most promising ones. And some of them you give awards to, which is a list that you've announced just this week. Talk us through some of those winners.
Yeah, I'd love to. So BNEF Pioneers, this innovation competition, has been running now since 2010. And every year we have about 10 to 12 winners out of hundreds of applicants. And more recently, we've been picking themes for the year. There are so many interesting companies out there, but BNEF wants to try and pick companies that are relevant for today's problems and really for actually tackling climate change or decarbonization before 2030. It's great if there's a 2050 solution, but we can't wait that long. So this year, we chose three challenge areas. We want to relieve the bottlenecks on the grid. There's loads of issues with permitting right now to get renewables on the grid. There are some tech solutions. Second is decarbonizing buildings and the built environment. Huge cause of emissions. We're still not entirely sure how to get there economically. And the third is let's just try and develop a great next-gen net zero fuel, because right now we're really struggling to know how to decarbonize aviation, shipping and trucking.
And just to give the listeners a flavor of the kinds of startups that end up winning this award, what are your favorite examples from this year's winners?
Well, yeah, so we have, I think, 11 winners this year, and they're all great, obviously. But the ones we could talk about, I think, exemplify some of the themes we've already discussed. There's a couple of really great ones in the relieving grid bottlenecks challenge. Many people think that's just about permitting and policy, but there's some cool tech stuff. One example actually is a hardware company example called TS Conductor. They're US-based, and they have basically developed a technology. It's a carbon fiber core wrapped with aluminium wrapped around it, which will triple the line capacity, i.e. how much power you can push down an existing above-ground power line. That's huge, because one of the huge issues with building out the grid is permitting to build new wooden poles in the ground. If you can replace those wires and triple the power capacity and halve line losses, that's amazing. It's a 4-year payback. The issue TS Conductor has is it's expensive. We talked about that before. And utilities in the US are regulated to not spend lots of money. So they're going to struggle to sell this stuff. It's 2 to 3 times the cost. And they invented an interesting model to do exactly that, basically try and get it deployed.
So you replace the copper cable with a cable that's made out of carbon fiber and aluminum.
So it's currently aluminum, yeah, in the US wires, wrapped around steel core. The steel helps strengthen the aluminium and stops it from sagging. But you only push so much power through the aluminium before all the wires sag. And I'm sure you've seen sagging wires in the US. Very, very dangerous. What the composite core does, it's just 10 times stronger than steel. So you can actually push plenty more current through the aluminium and it won't sag because of the carbon fiber core. It is expensive, but yeah.
Well, they're also coming in at a time where copper prices are going up. The ability to get copper cables has been a real struggle for the grid industry. So that's a good example. What's another one?
So in the buildings challenge, we have some great companies. One particularly has been around for a long time. So AeroSeal, they were founded in 1996. They were actually bought by Carrier in 2001, I believe. And it just went nowhere. And that can happen. Big companies buy a startup, don't know what to do with it, let it languish. The founder, the initial founder of AeroSeal, rebought the company from Carrier in 2010 because he could just see it going nowhere. And since then, they've managed to scale massively. They are making lots of money. They, I think, have now done about 200,000 kind of installations of their product. And that product is they basically can retrofit commercial or residential buildings or new builds to be fully sealed, i.e. airtight, almost passive house standard, which obviously reduces losses. So it's basically an energy efficiency play.
I actually got a chance to go and visit one of the AeroSeal processes in the US, in Massachusetts. And yeah, we just entered a random person's home and they were kind enough to let us in to see how they do it. And it's fascinating. Like, you, of course, have to leave the house for that period and you have to let it dry and everything. But you don't have to deconstruct the house to put it back together to try and get this insulation in place. So we do need real good solutions for insulation. And it's really nice to see a startup that is no longer a startup, I guess. It's 20 years old, coming back to life. Now, the final example that you have is a steel company. And this is where you take H2 Green Steel, which is a hydrogen-powered steel production, which may not go down the green premium path as one would like. But there are these other startups that are coming up with even cheaper ways of making carbon-free steel.
Yeah, there's only very few ways to decarbonize steel. You basically make it as you do and add carbon capture, always be more expensive. You instead reduce your iron ore with hydrogen rather than natural gas, which is what H2 Green Steel is doing. Or you could electrify the whole process. That's really tricky, not done currently at scale. But actually, we've now got 3 BNEF Pioneers winners who are doing that. In the past, we gave Boston Metal the award, last year Electra, and this year Element Zero. All 3 are forms of basically electrolysis. Element Zero is interesting. It's still very early stage, but they promise a couple of things that's a bit different. One is they say they're not using a membrane and they're not using carbon electrodes. So there's no direct process CO2 emissions from the carbon electrodes. And the membrane is very expensive and technically kind of fussy part of the system. So they're cutting out that cost and that risk. The second cool thing is they say that they can operate with renewable intermittent energy. So obviously, if you're going to electrify a process to make it a zero, it needs to use clean power. The cheapest clean power is solar and wind, but it isn't running all the time. So unlike other electrification processes for industry that need to be 24/7, really power reliability, what Element Zero can do is actually be off for up to 4 hours, which is really cool. It's to do with the heat capacity of the solvent it's using.
Now, I've been particularly fascinated by these electric options. And the electrolysis part is very simply just using electricity to do the chemical reaction that was being done either by hydrogen or coal, where they basically take the oxygen atom out from the iron ore, which is iron oxide. Now, Electra, which is the other pioneer winner, has reached pilot stage. They are actually making tons of this material, sending it out to steelmakers. What stage is Element Zero at?
They're still very early stage. I mean, more like a lab stage. I mean, they might say pilot, but definitely behind Electra. They want to build their first commercial facility in 2029. So they're at Series A. If we go back to the VC discussion, they raised about $10 million and they're at Series A. They have some private wealthy individuals that also are helping fund them, but really they're a way off building their first commercial project.
And like you said, many of these startups like Element Zero are very early stage. With the funding landscape changing so much, it'll be interesting to see how they survive and perhaps thrive. Thank you, Claire.
Thanks for having me.
For more on decarbonizing steel, you can listen to an episode of Zero from 2022 on Electra, and you can hear more on climate investing trends on Bloomberg NEF's podcast, Switched On. Links to all that in the show notes. Thank you for listening to Zero. If you like this episode, please take a moment to rate or review the show on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Share this episode with a friend or with a science nerd. You can get in touch at zeropod@bloomberg.net. Zero's producers are Maithili Rao, Magnus Henriksen, and Somar Sadi. Our theme music is composed by Wonderly. Special thanks to Kira Bindram and Jessica Nix. I'm Akshat Rathi. Back soon.